Support for podcasting on KBIA comes from Grindstone Fitness Studio, a full-service gym offering equipment for more traditional exercise such as weight and cardiovascular training, as well as specialized classes. Choices include personal training, spinning, yoga, Pilates, and more. All classes taught by certified professionals. More information is available at 443-4447. Grindstone Fitness Studio, 3005 Chinaberry Drive in Columbia.
It's Wednesday, June 11, 2014, and this is KBIA's Views of the News. Our weekly roundtable on media behaviors comes to you from the Futures Lab studio at the Reynolds Journalism Institute. I'm Amy Simons. Here with me are Missouri School of Journalism colleagues Mike McKean and Catherine Reed. On our program this week, Time Inc. spins off from Time Warner. Is it a risky move for the magazine giant? The many forms of advertising and public relations take on things that we may not even realize, including the form of documentary film. And the dating website eHarmony has 15 reasons why reporters make good life partners. I'll run some of them by our panelists and see what they think. But I want to start with a topic that has many, especially here in an area saturated with colleges and universities, talking. A Washington Post column Friday penned by George Will. In it, the conservative wrote of what he calls the supposed campus epidemic of rape, aka sexual assault. He attributes the rise in the number of reported attacks to increased political correctness on college campuses, which he said when universities, again quoting here, making victimhood a coveted status that confers privileges, victims proliferate. What exactly is the point he's trying to make here?
Well, I mean, this isn't the first time that Will has written about sort of government overreach or political correctness on college campuses. And he even, you know, toward the end of that column, made some points that some people would agree with regard to speech codes and this new thing of trigger warnings in classrooms. I mean, those are problems for free speech advocates. But that whole message, if that's what he was trying to say, got completely swamped by this stupid thing that he said about sexual assault. I mean, being raped is not a coveted or privileged status. It's not.
Mm-hmm. And Catherine, this is a subject you have edited countless stories on, right, taken the lead with at the Missourian. Is this just an attempt at being provocative?
I just think he must be incredibly confused. And I was so surprised by the level of ignorance that it reflected about rape reporting. You know, so if this is a coveted status that endows privilege on the person who reports, why do we have so few reports? You know, we did a story that we published last year about how few cases go to our student disciplinary office. Two in 2012 compared to 90 some reports to the RSVP center, mm-hmm, and then 14 reports to MU police in that same year. So even when women come forward and report, they do so with great reluctance. So that strongly suggests, and I have seen this in my own reporting back in the day, that it's an unpleasant process. And it's still too unpleasant, and it still subjects women to scorn. And on social media, the abuse that we saw the woman take in the Michael Dixon case on Twitter was shocking to people on our campus. And so there is obviously no privilege attached to it. It was a very strange target for him to choose.
There are a whole lot of people calling for the Post to cut ties with him. Is this something that reaches that level?
I don't think it's going to occur. I mean, already the editorial page editor for the Washington Post has defended him, saying this is exactly what a columnist should do, stirring up ideas. Hey, we're going to print a lot of other viewpoints that are different from Will's. And so I seriously doubt, even with sort of the social media, and we talked about how they tend to ramp up these kinds of controversies, I don't think he's going to be fired, whether you believe he should be or not.
Well, if the question is, should he be, I would be somewhat encouraged to see that happen, actually. I think that this kind of point of view is it needs to go away. And if George Will can't do better as a journalist than to do so little research on the subject that he's writing about, you know, I don't know that he deserves a platform.
I mean, I do think there ought to be, and there is in some quarters and in some media, a conversation about why we see such an epidemic of sexual assaults on campuses. And I hope we'll have that conversation without falling back on all the politically correct stereotypes. For example, I mean, Ruth Marcus wrote a piece in the Washington Post back in the fall where she was talking about how a journalist at Slate had said, you know, young women need to understand there's a binge drinking problem on campus. Right. And it's not blaming the victim to say that maybe you need to be careful and take care of yourself. But there are a lot of critics out there that don't want to hear that argument. They will immediately say you're blaming the victim if you talk about anything other than penalties against the rapist.
Right. And others have implied that it's just sexist to suggest that people should exercise very good judgment in how much they drink. We did a story this spring, a pretty big story, about alcohol and sexual assault and how often alcohol plays a role in sexual assault. And we proceeded with great care because of that Slate column. Right. I was aware of some of the minefields ahead, but it is a really important subject for people to be discussing freely.
And I've got to say, I mean, it's easy to talk about, you know, the culture, but I do think that the media contribute in some negative ways to the culture that allows for this kind of behavior. I'll just give you an example. The Huffington Post media critic wrote a piece about the George Will here this past week, and running down the side and below that column were teases for these stories. Kris Jenner approves of Kendall's topless photo shoot. Katy Perry rocks itsy bitsy teeny weeny yellow bikini. Penis size study yields surprise about women's preferences. 13 synonyms for vagina we hate most. I mean, we are enabling and magnifying our culture's obsession with objectifying women.
And some of those appearing in the rail or down below a story are done through an automatic algorithm by looking at some of the words that are included in that story. Well, this all makes our next topic even harder to discuss. Tech Week Chicago has apologized for sending out this invitation to a charity event showing scantily clad women in several poses as if in a photo booth, leaning up against one another and in one of the photos kissing. Several industry leaders tweeted their disgust over the imagery used in that invite, and some have even questioned what presenting sponsor Microsoft would have said had they seen that advertising before it went out. Organizers have apologized, saying the intent was never to alienate or to offend, but that wasn't enough for one of the media sponsors, Crain Chicago Business. Crain's pulled its sponsorship of the entire Tech Week event and has run several op-eds about the need for a change in the tech industry's attitude towards women. There are a couple of issues to bring up here. Mike, we have spoken on this program in the past about the marginalization of women, both in journalism startups, in tech startups, and this is how one of those events centering around that industry is moving
And that's
forward.
Because this industry is dominated by young men. I mean, you can look in our computer science department or computer science programs around the country. The number of women in those programs has actually decreased over the past 20 years rather than grown. And this is just one example. I mean, you've got links to some other examples on our blog about a guy in Germany at a tech conference comparing an app to his girlfriend. Or there was a conference where a couple of guys from Australia rolled out this fake app called the Tits app. And it's just dominant in this profession. And I don't really know what we do about it except to continue to expose it when it comes out.
Right. And hope that, you know, we'll see more women in computer science. We'll see more female programmers. And then the culture will change. I mean, the positive sign in this is how quickly Crain's responded to it. And I went and looked up Crain's masthead thinking, oh, maybe there's a lot of women in management at Crain's. Well, like the top three editors are men, but the advertising and marketing director is a woman. And I would imagine that she had some role in the discussion that took place at Crain's about making this decision. So it's just some nice evidence, actually, that when women have some management positions in journalism, and in companies in general, you know, they're going to have more influence about decisions like these.
So let's bring this back to the idea of the journalism side of this. Crain's was one of the media sponsors who pulled out of this program. Mm-hmm. There are several others in the Chicago market that have not, the Chicago Tribune being one of them. We see this even here in the Mid-Missouri area, KOMU, KBIA, other outlets in town become media sponsors for events, if it's Roots and Blues, if it's True False. Mm-hmm. How do you decide, or how can your credibility as a news organization become tied into how that event conducts its business?
I mean, don't you think, Catherine, it's going to be a real problem for media organizations that are seeing events as a way to extend their audience engagement and ultimately to get more revenue by saying, we're going to sponsor the... You can never know. Even the most reputable seeming organization can do something really dumb like this, and then your reputation's on the line too.
Right, I know. And they make, and I think these organizations make these decisions very carefully because they're financial decisions. Mm-hmm. You know, you're putting up cash, you're putting up your name. But as Mike's pointed out, you know, anything can happen. And you see this in sports sponsorship. It's the situation that companies face when they sponsor some wonderful athlete, you know, who ends up doing something really terrible. And then it's just damage control.
Or we saw that with the LA Clippers in the past month or so after comments from Sterling. Well, we're a documentary town, right? Home of the True False Film Festival we were just talking about. And the School of Journalism will soon be home to the brand new Jonathan B. Murray Center for Documentary Journalism. Well, let's talk about this new film produced by Tyler Perry. Here is an excerpt from Spent, Looking for Change.
Every month we spend anywhere from $2,800 to $3,500.
Sometimes I'm left with hardly anything.
Sometimes it's nail biting. It's a roller coaster.
I have all this massive debt behind me and it feels so overwhelming.
We all want to get the most out of life. A great family, an education, a business, a home.
It's a 3-bedroom/4.
But for a growing number of Americans, the price of getting ahead is higher because of a financial system that leaves millions underserved.
You just have to kind of tuck your chin to your chest and keep going forward.
Don't give up, even when you want to.
There's not ever the option to not make it work. I have to.
I think you'll agree it has the look and the feel of most in the documentary genre. The film runs close to 40 minutes, showing the plight of everyday Americans without traditional access to banks and struggling to make ends meet. It has a website full of details on the people who are featured in it, has information on how you can host a screening. But hidden in all of that, hidden in the film even, is the fact that the whole thing was commissioned by and is a commercial for American Express. Documentaries often have a point of view, a point that they're trying to make. Producers of Blackfish wanted you to walk away upset about the treatment of whales at SeaWorld. The producers of Bully wanted you to walk away having a full understanding of the impact bullying has on family members, on communities, on the person bullied themselves. The difference here was this was commissioned by a corporate entity. American Express is behind the whole thing.
Well, right. I mean, the difference being that those films that you cited, like Blackfish
Bully.
Bully, yeah, are selling an idea. And American Express is selling an idea to sell a product. And that's these prepaid cards that American Express is marketing. Mm-hmm. But transparency and the problem of transparency in filmmaking and documentary filmmaking is a subject that interests me a lot as a journalist. And I love documentary film and it can be incredibly powerful. And that's great. And that's also a problem. You know, it really assumes a very high level of sophistication on the part of the viewer to know who's made this. Where did the money come from? Why is this film being made? And this film doesn't show its hand until
38 minutes and 18 seconds into the 39 minutes and 56 seconds. So you have 40 minutes and it takes till 38:18 where it just comes up on a slide.
But they also, if you watch this on YouTube or Hulu or other places, there is information about the sponsorship and links back to American Express. I mean, I will grant there is a slippery slope anytime a company is paying for something that supports what they're trying to do, which in the end is to sell these prepaid cards as an alternative, I must say, though, to payday lenders, check cashing services, pawn shops. What difference would it make if this documentary were paid for by a nonprofit organization that endorsed exactly what American Express is trying to do? If they're trying to you know, sell a public good, should we automatically discount it? I mean, I would prefer that news organizations, that independent documentary producers would do a documentary about this subject. But if they can't or won't, I don't necessarily have a problem with American Express paying for it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that just because American Express made it doesn't mean that it isn't serving an important purpose. I mean, journalists have tried for years and years and years to expose what's called the poverty industry, mm-hmm. the payday loan companies, the rent-to-own companies. And what American Express has done is produced a product that addresses a problem in our society that doesn't discredit it. I'm not sure this is an example of a poor way to do this, but I am concerned a little bit about how sophisticated the media consumer is about sources of funding. And when you have very high quality filmmaking, as you see in this film, people are really swept up in it. You know, I'm happy to hear Mike say that that's really clear on the website, and because I think that's important.
And on the website, if you look at the trailer for Spent, it has an American Express logo superimposed onto it. If you watch the film itself, it does not. Then again, if you go to YouTube or Hulu, in the information below the video itself, it has more of that information there.
I was just going to say, too, I mean, and I think maybe you might be getting to this, but we've talked several times in this program about the growing influence of so-called native advertising.
Go for it. That's where I was going to go next.
Well, so there are lots of newspapers and other media outlets that are now encouraging and setting up entire divisions that are designed to draft journalism-like products for sponsors. And it isn't always as crude as when we were criticizing The Atlantic a year or so ago for running a piece about Scientology. Something like this that serves a public good, and it might not necessarily be as transparent with the sources. Many news organizations now are seeing this as a source of revenue. So we're going to have more of this, not less.
Mm-hmm. So another question that I had about this, the 40-minute commercial here from American Express, Coca-Cola with the World Cup coming up starting in the next week, a 5-minute commercial there. Are we starting to see, do you think this is also a new trend, kind of as an offshoot of that native advertising, corporations not seeing the need or the same value in that 30-second spot, that perhaps they can take a more long-form approach to advertising and have a deeper connection with consumers that way?
Oh, I think that most people are seeing the longer form as having lots of value. But, you know, the thing about this film is it's not that different from some of these feature-length documentaries that you can see when you scroll through Netflix mm-hmm. that have been made by political action committees or right. particular causes. So, you know, it's fair game for everyone.
And, you know, you have some that are kind of in the middle. I mean, you think about this Chipotle campaign that they did, and, you know, they actually built a little game around the Scarecrow character. Well, that is in some ways advocacy for admirable public policy, but it's also polishing Chipotle's image. So you can have mixed messages, and it is our job as journalists not just to provide a platform for that, but to talk about it, too.
Well, this is not exactly in my wheelhouse because it's about advertising.
Right, we are more editorial side of the house.
But the thing about the Chipotle thing that struck me, and Mike, maybe you can comment on this, is that it is so funny that mm-hmm. I'm not sure it's effective advertising. At some point, it became so entertaining to me that I thought, you know, I don't know what happens at that juncture.
I mean, other people who've written about it, I'm not an expert in advertising either, but say that it was very effective in engaging people, especially young people, in sort of seeing this as an authentic issue that you could have fun with and still learn something about. And you clearly got people to spend a lot of time talking about genetically modified food and all of that they would not have spent with a story that you or I might have written about it.
Exactly. No, that's a good point.
Well, so when I saw this headline at first for our next topic, I was convinced it had to have been something from The Onion or some other satirical site. Then I realized it was from Ad Age. Yesterday, 11 of the top public relations firms issued a joint statement vowing not to make any changes to their clients' Wikipedia entries on the sly. Maybe I'm showing my naivete here, but why were they doing that in the first place?
Why were PR companies doing it? Well, because they were being paid a lot of money by folks whose companies had said,
fair
my
enough.
Wikipedia page, there are people saying critical things about our brand or untrue things about our brand. You
I'm
go, in,
go
there
in
and fix
that.
It.
Yeah. What obligation does Wikipedia have to keep those folks honest?
I don't know how that works.
It's open, a crowdsource, right? Open source encyclopedia.
You see entries that say, you know, some of the information in this citation is unverified or suspect, mm-hmm. or someone has raised a flag. But gosh, who can keep up with that?
Yeah.
You know, Wikipedia is huge, and they do invite people to support them and I also to try to flag information that, you know, feels like it has a spin or is inaccurate. But
they have checks and balances and processes for addressing this kind of thing. And, I mean, they also will argue that it's self-correcting over time because it is crowdsourced. But I really don't see why a company or a PR agency, for that matter, should have any less right to go in and make some comment about a Wikipedia page than any other person with any other axe to grind might have.
I don't know that Wikipedia has ever been the most reliable
right.
source out there. Maybe I'll go to get, you know, list of episode names for a TV show or something along the line. But that's probably it. What you're about to hear now is the sound of Time Inc. ringing the opening bell at the New York Stock Exchange Monday. That there marked the magazine company's spinoff from Time Warner. The publishers of such iconic brands as People, Time, Sports Illustrated, and Fortune are going at it alone for the first time, forming a separate company from its more profitable cousins, HBO and Warner Brothers. How big of a risk is this?
Well, it's like they cut them loose in a lifeboat that's got a hole in it. I mean, it's how much debt do they have? That's a tough way to start life, right? So I don't know what changes are in store for Time Inc. and what sort of magic it's going to take to pay down that debt and do something to bring back readers.
And most of the media companies that have a lot of magazines, if you think of Hearst, for example, are really or Meredith, they're making their money. They're propping up the magazines with television stations
right.
and other media. So they don't have this available to
right,
them.
Right, which is what had been going on there, being mm-hmm. able to rely on HBO, being able to rely on CNN or other entities. While we bring up HBO, also wanted to mention there's some word coming out that Vice Media, which has been known for its rather provocative magazine and now the half-hour magazine program on HBO, Time Warner is looking to buy a stake in that one.
I mean, what does that say? They're spinning off a venerable old title like mm-hmm. Time Magazine or Sports Illustrated, buying up these new media brands that are more provocative, more effective at using social media. So that's where they think the future is.
$2.2 billion is what Vice Media has been valued at this time.
By the way, before we get off this
topic,
can I just say when we were talking a few moments ago about the Time Inc. Spinoff, CNBC was running a piece about this, Business Channel. And to go back to our first couple of topics, mm-hmm. the image that they ran at the top of that story was, well, it could have been a lot of things, an iconic Time Inc. cover or, you know, NBA champions from Sports Illustrated. It was the 2013 Sports Illustrated swimsuit edition.
I saw that.
With Kate Upton, the model, nearly naked on the cover. That's what they used as an image for their coverage.
Yeah.
How much of that is trying to attract what is generally believed to be the predominantly male audience of CNBC and trying to connect that same synergy that would be going on there and going for what is a rather sexist approach.
I imagine so. And I'm just going to be so happy when that stops being a reflexive response. Like that's the image, the iconic image that we want to.
And that was a conscious decision mm-hmm, that some editor made. And it was all about trying to appeal to mm-hmm. the demographic they target.
Right.
Well, data doesn't lie, right? Well, except maybe when it does. There was a story that was published yesterday on USA Today College that ranked journalism schools using data crunched by an organization called College Factual. The Missouri School of Journalism shows up on their list, albeit lower than most might expect in our field. Some other journalism schools not normally ranked as highly showed up in the top 10, namely Pepperdine and the University of California, Irvine. Catherine, I noticed on Twitter you had a lot to say about this, including some interactions with folks at both College Factual and USA Today. But more than just where the Missouri School of Journalism may have fallen in rankings, because that's neither here nor there. Things are going to be different by different people at any time. There are some real transparency issues that are going on.
Well, no. And actually, I would disagree with falling in rankings. There are competing rankings.
Okay.
This is a different methodology than has been applied to journalism schools. And when I looked closely...
You mean because weather seemed to have been factored in this time around?
No,
okay,
but
we can't compete with Irvine.
What they did is they looked at the university's overall ranking, and that had a big impact on that School of Journalism's ranking. And so the relationship between the Missouri School of Journalism and the University of Missouri, there was a big influence there. And that's why we ended up with this ranking that was lower. And so did UNC Chapel Hill. And so did all these other public institutions,
that, Florida, Maryland,
right, that have been historically ranked in the top 10. So this was a very novel list. I should have looked at their methodology first before I tweeted at them. Lesson for me, because that's their methodology. I don't know that rankings mean as much as we all wish they did. I think in order to value journalism schools, we'd have to all go look at all of them. And I suspect what we would find is that there are a lot of people doing really interesting work in a lot of places.
I mean, if you're a prospective student or a parent of a student that wants to go into journalism, if you look at any of these rankings, whatever the company is that produces them, you're probably going to do a disservice to yourself. You need to do a lot more research than looking at those numbers.
Well, and I would always say it doesn't matter where you go to school. It's what you make of the education and the experiences that are offered to you while you're there. So if you are interested in looking at that story, it is on our links blog. We'll tell you how to find it in just a bit. Before we go, some dating advice from eHarmony.com. Single? Looking? Consider dating a reporter. The online matchmaking site says journalists make good life partners because they're trustworthy, punctual, and great conversationalists. They can tell when you're lying, they're up on current events, and can catch you up when you're feeling a bit out of touch. Mike, Catherine, you guys are married. I'm not.
I'm married to a journalist, 27 years. And no, he is not punctual. I can tell you that. the list is really funny and pretty endearing. And I like that somebody said something nice about the interesting qualities of journalists, especially being conversationalists. You'd want to have it at a dinner party. People have said that for years.
I like the one that, you know, reporters are self-employed. Where did they get that? And a commenter said, I think you meant unemployed.
Freelance.
The other thing I would say is that, you know, yeah, we're good conversationalists. If you mean we do all the conversing and you do all the listening. And I think the thing we like to talk about more than anything is, I hate my job. I hate my fellow employees. I hate my sources. I hate my boss. We're really good at bitching and complaining.
Another one of the favorites that I had on that list, having been and having dated journalists in the past too, was, well, they have a good understanding of deadlines. And another one of the comments was, well, yeah, that's because they're always on them. Dated journalists and the chance of you either having the date broken or you get stood up that much higher because they're worried more about their deadline than anything else. That music means we're pretty much out of time for this week. I'd like to thank you for spending the last half hour with us. Read more about the topics we talked about today on our links blog. That's under the programs tab at kbia.org. Like us on Facebook or follow us on Twitter. Our handle is @viewsonkbia. These are all great ways to watch and listen to our program again. Leave us comments, questions, see previews of what we'll be talking about next week, and more. Our thanks to RJI's Travis McMillan for directing today's show, and to Pat Akers for handling the audio. Hope Kerwin is our associate producer. I'm Amy Simons. Be sure to join us again next week when we're back with you for another edition of Views of the News.